This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. The images were horrifying. Railroad cars hanging off an interstate overpass. A train derailment in Washington State left 3 people dead. President Trump tweeted that the train accident shows why his infrastructure plan must be approved and quickly. In Atlanta, another system failure. Thousands of travelers were stranded after an 11-hour airport power outage just days before Christmas. This hour on Point, the state of American infrastructure and the promises to fix it. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the back-to-back catastrophes involving our rail and air transportation? How's the infrastructure where you live? The bridges, the roads, the airports, the power grid? So President Trump has promised from the start to lead a huge national infrastructure upgrade. Here he was in an address to Congress back in February.
To launch our national rebuilding, I will be asking Congress to approve legislation that produces a $1 trillion investment in infrastructure of the United States, financed through both public and private capital, creating millions of new jobs.
But in the meantime, tax cuts took precedence for President Trump and his Republican supporters in Congress. But yesterday, when the president gave his this week earlier, when the president gave his national security strategy speech, he identified national prosperity as the second pillar of his strategy. And part of national prosperity, he said, is infrastructure. Here he was.
The strategy proposes a complete rebuilding of American infrastructure, our roads, bridges, airports, waterways, and communications infrastructure. And it embraces a future of American energy dominance and self-sufficiency.
And joining me now from Washington is Lauren Gardner. She's the transportation reporter for Politico Pro. And you can find her latest piece headlined, Amtrak Derailment Revives Debate Over Delayed Anti-Crash Technology. That's on our website, onpointradio.org. Lauren Gardner, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
So, Lauren, President Trump, in the aftermath of the train crash in Washington State, says it, quote, shows more than ever why our soon-to-be-submitted infrastructure plan must be approved quickly. But what connection is there, if any, between that train crash and the problem of crumbling infrastructure?
Well, that's the thing, Tom. When it comes to this particular instance, this is a case where the Amtrak train was traveling on recently refurbished track. This wasn't, you know, track that had not been rehabilitated for years and years. This was the product of a $180 million stimulus project to add passenger trains onto this section of track and help shorten the time between Seattle and point southward. So this was the inaugural day of service for this brand new section of track to shorten times and get passenger trains away from freight lines.
And you've written, in terms of what caused the crash, you've discussed this new technology called positive train control. Briefly describe what that is and how that may or may not be related to, its use may or may not be related to this crash.
Sure. Well, positive train control is actually the concept has been pushed for many, many years by the NTSB, but Congress only mandated it for passenger and many freight railroads back in 2008. And the technology uses GPS and spectrum and other equipment to track train movements, and it can control their speeds if it finds that an engineer has set the train to be moving too fast. It can prevent head-on collisions. And when it comes to this particular incident, we don't know yet whether PTC could have prevented it. NTSB is still determining whether this was, in fact, human error or if there was some kind of mechanical failure on board the train, which PTC couldn't have prevented. But given that speed is at least some sort of factor here, since we know that the train was moving 80 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone, it has raised a lot of questions about whether or not PTC could or should have been on board the train.
Well, okay. So even though the infrastructure issues in our country may not have contributed to that crash, certainly it provided an opportunity, a sort of a reminder of why, the larger issue of the state of our railroads is critical.
Certainly. And it also brings into focus that rail is not funded the same way that other modes of transportation are around the country. When it comes to highways and transit, they're funded by the Highway Trust Fund, which is fed by the federal gas tax, and also lately other Congress has turned up the couch cushions in other areas of government to help prop it up, since we get less bang for our buck now on the gas tax with cars traveling less and getting more miles to the gallon. But there is no trust fund for rail. And also Amtrak shares the rails with freights across most of the country, pretty much outside of the Northeast Corridor. So it's freight rail track or state-owned track, so they're the ones responsible for keeping it up. There's no federal nexus there.
Okay. The state of our railroad infrastructure is very important, and we're going to get back to that. But let's consider the other big incident this week, which was the power outage at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport. Rutia Curry was stranded there, and she said tensions were high during that power outage.
Once we walk down the escalator, which was a nightmare, then we have to go through the tunnels that are pitch black. It's scary. You don't know. It's like snatch your bags, whatever, you know. That was a nightmare.
And Lauren Gardner, certainly the state of our power grid is an infrastructure issue. I think it's probably possible to tie this particular incident to our infrastructure problem a little bit more directly, correct?
It may be. From what we know about this particular instance, it sounds like an unfortunate incident where a fire started and it happened to wipe out not the main power source to the airport, but also their backup. So the backup power source was placed in very close proximity to the main system. So that raises the question of why was the backup system not a little bit further away to prevent against a case like that where some outside factor wiped out the main source. But in terms of what this means for our nation's airports, this might be one, particular instance, but the airports in general, there's been a lot of questions, especially since the presidential campaign, of what can be done to shore up and improve the infrastructure we already have, especially since airports have largely been built out in the last 50 or so years across the country.
Okay, let's take a kind of a big view here, Lauren, of the infrastructure challenges that our country faces. I don't know whether you can rank the problems that we have, but kind of give us a sort of a overall perspective of what we're looking at in terms of the infrastructure deficiencies in our country right now across all sectors.
Well, I don't know if I can rank them, but there is a backlog that groups have been monitoring that is in the billions of dollars. And really the issue here is, where does the money come from? That's kind of the age-old question, especially here in Washington, is how do you get the money to not only maintain things, but if they have fallen so far behind, bring them back into a state of good repair. So you see that on the highway system. You see that in transit systems across the country, too, since they're also reliant on federal money. And also, indeed, with airports, and they're funded by their own charges and fees and whatnot. So it all goes back to, where does the money come from?
Where does the money come from? Okay, let's go now to Robert Puentes. He is president and CEO of the ENO Center for Transportation. That organization receives some funding from American Airlines and Intel, among other organizations. Robert Puentes, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me again.
So same question for you, Robert, that I just posed to Lauren. Sort of give us a quick overview of what you think are the major issues right now in the country regarding the state of our infrastructure.
Well, I think it's clear that we have an infrastructure deficit. As Lauren said, there have been numerous reports that have quantified, you know, just what the estimates are for repairs and upgrades and modernization, all that stuff. So we do have some good numbers on that. But I think the challenge that we have is that this big national conversation around infrastructure is very abstract and simplistic. We talk about infrastructure as if it means something very specific to people, but we don't think about it that way. It's really roads and bridges or the power grid or the train systems. Whatever it is, it actually has real specific tangible impacts on people's lives. So we've got to get specific about what it is we're talking about. We then also, I think, tend to overemphasize the federal role because we have these reports that show trillions of dollars of needs. People think, oh, this is just too big for anybody but the federal government to deal with. Let's see what Washington can do. And we know that, you know, this is a very difficult time here in Washington, and we don't have, as Lauren said, a lot of money to pay for some of this stuff. So we've got to think about new kinds of partnerships and new ways to get things done between all levels of government and the public and the private sectors. And then we've got to connect it to national priorities. Infrastructure for infrastructure's sake doesn't matter to anybody. But when we see what happened in Atlanta, this is an economic question. It's the world's busiest airport. It really shouldn't be subject to the problems that happened down there. The safety questions that happened in Seattle, safety should be absolutely paramount. So once we take infrastructure out of its box and connect it to other areas that matter, you've completely changed the conversation, but we've failed to do that in this country.
We've failed to do that in this country. You know, we've been hearing about the problems with our infrastructure for so many years. Why has it been so hard to confront these issues? I mean, you and others have written that we're behind other countries in maintenance of our infrastructure. Why is this so difficult?
Well, we've done a good job in this country building new stuff, right? Especially in the 1950s and 60s, and the country was growing, the economy was booming, and we were building a lot of new things and cutting the proverbial ribbon in front of new infrastructure, and that's great. We're at a point in this country now where we really need to focus on the rehabilitation, the maintenance, the upgrading, and the modernization of the infrastructure that exists today. I think when we have this big national conversation around crumbling infrastructure, you know, we think about bridges falling down and what's happened with the subway systems, but we really need to focus on making sure that the system is running as efficiently as possible.
And we are discussing the power outage at Atlanta's airport and also the deadly train derailment in Washington State. President Trump says it shows why we need to consider his new infrastructure plan and quickly. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're examining the state of America's transportation and infrastructure in light of the deadly train accident in the Pacific Northwest and that 11-hour power outage at Atlanta's airport this week. You can join the conversation. Have you been delayed or stranded due to inefficiencies or damage to our national infrastructure? How's your community managing? And the issue of our infrastructure crumbling has been around for a long time. Recall how 10 years ago, on August 1st, 2007, the Interstate 35 West Bridge over the Mississippi River in Minneapolis collapsed. Here's ABC's Martin Bashir with the story that evening.
An eight-lane highway that carries over 100,000 cars a day collapsed into the Mississippi River at the height of rush hour. At this point, we know that at least seven people are dead, and that figure may yet increase. At the moment, according to the Coast Guard, dozens of cars and trucks remain in the water completely submerged.
And the death toll in that incident eventually rose to 13, with 145 injured. I'm talking this hour with Lauren Gardner. She's transportation reporter for Politico Pro, and Robert Puentes, president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. And Robert, what did that bridge collapse indicate, or what was it symptomatic of with regard in particular to the state of our bridges around the country?
Well, clearly that tragedy amplified the issue of safety around bridges. Again, anything related to safety and public health certainly pushes this infrastructure issue closer to the front burner of the policy discourse. And we had a big national conversation around raising money to fix all our bridges. And there was a big flurry of conversation in Congress and everywhere else. And then nothing happened on the federal level. I mean, there is a bridge program, and there was some larger emphasis on making sure that everything was in a state of good repair. And states actually did a really good job in assessing their bridge infrastructure and making sure it was in the right shape it was supposed to be. But I think that this crisis-driven approach doesn't seem to be working. We have this flurry of activity that happens when tragedy strikes, when a water main breaks or the bridge collapses or the power grid goes down. And there's a big national flurry of activity, but then we kind of move away from it. And I think that we need to not just focus on infrastructure when tragedy strikes, even though we need to do it then, but we really need to have a more positive and affirmative vision instead of the hand-wringing that goes on when catastrophes occur.
And Lauren Gardner, as we've said, President Trump has been talking about infrastructure for well over a year since during his presidential campaign. Now that we are on the verge of his big tax bill being passed, it appears he's going to turn his attention to the infrastructure issue. What can you tell us about what the administration has in mind and what its prospects are?
Sure. Well, it sure looks that way. The administration is sending out signals that they're planning to finally release this infrastructure plan next month ahead of the State of the Union address. And in terms of the drip, drip, drip of information that's come out over the last several months on this and has kind of sped up over the last few weeks, is that we're expecting a plan that includes $200 billion in federal funding that would be divided into four kind of categories. And the main one that the administration is pitching is this one where some of these dollars would be funneled towards programs that would be geared towards getting state and local governments to come up with a greater share of the money for the projects that they need in their own backyards. So whether they come up with it on their own by raising taxes or setting some other sort of fees or going to the private sector and leveraging money that way and using what's called public-private partnerships, they don't care how the state or local government would do it, just that they can get a bigger chunk of money, apply for additional funding from the federal government, but say, look, we have the bulk of the funding here. We just need a little bit more from you to get this over the start line, so to speak.
Well, Robert Prentice, you said earlier that we probably have paid, emphasized too much the role of the federal government in this regard. So how do you react to this notion of sort of passing the buck, if that's the right term, to state and local governments? Are they better equipped to deal with this? But, you know, what are the budget constraints that they would face?
I don't mean to suggest that we don't need to have a strong federal role in infrastructure. I just mean that the way that some infrastructure is funded and financed is just different. The railway network, for example, is largely privately driven. Water infrastructure is almost exclusively paid for by states and localities. I just think there's an impulse, a knee-jerk reaction to have the federal government be present where they're not now. That said, we are going through this this era of remaking federalism when it comes to infrastructure. And that's not the sexiest topic, but it really refers to, well, what are the roles of these different government levels going to be? And I think what we've seen happening on the metropolitan and the city level is that these places are not waiting around for Washington to figure out what they're going to do. And they're raising taxes. They're passing their own increases. They're going to the voters, and voters are approving referenda very regularly. About three quarters of these things seem to be passing. So it's a very, very different conversation happening in city, states, and metropolitan areas than what's happening here in the debt and dysfunction of Washington.
Okay. Let's go now to a caller. Steve is on the line from Berea, Kentucky. Steve, we're talking about infrastructure, and what's your view of the issue?
Hi, Tom. Well, my view is I work as a quality systems manager in the construction industry and safety and health manager as well, primarily on federal projects. And I absolutely agree the infrastructure money is necessary. The problem, from my perspective, if it was released today, is the shortage of skilled labor. You know, there's 148,000 to 200,000+ shortage of people to do the work. You know, if they release the money today, You've got to have skilled labor. And it's not somebody with a shovel. This is people that you've got to have people that are trained. You know, it's about their safety and about the quality of the product that comes out. And you know, you can't go down to your local unemployment office and hire people to produce something that's going to be in place for the next 30 years or 40 years.
What are the trades you're talking about, Steve, that are in short supply?
It's across the board. Millwrights are short supply. Equipment operators are short supply. Welders are, you know, it's just the entire general trades population. And if you look at it from a demographics perspective, you know, it's an aging workforce, and we don't have a lot of new people coming in to take those spots that are, you know, going through apprenticeship programs. And so, you know, that's if you look at the number of jobs that don't start on time because they can't find the labor to do it. Mm. You know, if you release $1 trillion today, how many projects are you going to be able to fill with the highly skilled people that you desperately need? These are, you know, it's not about the, you know, wages or you, but it really is. You've got to, you know, it's people that want to feed their family, make a profession out of it. It's,
okay. That's interesting, Steve. What you're suggesting is that the infrastructure issue is not just a matter of spending. It's a matter of training as well, bringing in the kind of skilled workers that can carry out these repairs. Let's bring in another voice to this conversation now. Joining us from Ithaca, New York, is Rick Geddes. He's a professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell University and the director of the Program in Infrastructure Policy. Rick Geddes, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
Interesting point there raised by our last caller, Steve, who says that, you know, even if we have the money to do this, we don't have the skilled workers to do it. It sounds like the issue of infrastructure repairs is multifaceted.
Absolutely, Tom. I think that's right. And I think that what the caller brought up is a broader point about the labor market in the U.S., you know, with regard to these skilled trades people, not just infrastructure repair in general. But Tom, I'd like to return to a point that Rob made earlier, which I think is really crucial to understanding and kind of tying together both of these events that we saw recently, both in Atlanta and in Seattle, even though they're in very different infrastructure sectors. You know, I think we should underscore what Rob said about the fundamental infrastructure challenge in the United States is now quite different than it was in the 20th century. So I think the 21st century has got to be a time when we shift our focus from building out, designing and constructing new systems, whether they be water systems, electrical systems, roads, bridges, tunnels, ports, airports, water, you know, et cetera, to taking care of what we have, to doing better operation and maintenance up to standards of the systems that we have. And I think that I'll try to put some flesh on the bones of that sort of 30,000-foot view. One is that the sectors that we see constantly that have that do pretty well in terms of infrastructure. And I think freight rail is an example of that. I think our electrical systems do pretty well. I think our drinking and wastewater systems need some upgrade, but I think they do pretty well overall. Airports, seaports, and then there's sectors which seem to consistently have some troubles, and that's our road system, which includes tunnels and bridges, et cetera. And I want to go back to the point I think that Lauren made earlier. This goes back to funding. How is the system funded? And from a policy perspective, we see that systems that are funded by sort of per unit user fees that cover the cost of the infrastructure, whether that's per kilowatt hour for electricity, per gallon for water, et cetera, you know, and the shippers obviously pay for the freight transportation system. Those systems have a reliable funding stream over time, a reliable revenue that covers their costs. Part of the problem, I think, with our road system, which seems to continuously have troubles with operation and maintenance, is that we rely on the tax system, and whether it's state gas taxes, federal taxes, et cetera. And that inherently has to be filtered through a political process, which sort of makes the funding a bit less reliable. And I think if we could get to a better funding system, that would lead us into this 21st century approach for the operation and maintenance.
Yeah.
That's one point, Tom. The other is I think the United States needs to borrow different – to utilize different delivery systems. And what I mean by that, Tom, is shift more to contracting out operation and maintenance. Now, this is not privatization. I'm not talking about privatization. I'm talking about doing what the majority of other developed countries do, which is to rely on contracting short-term contracts, maybe 5, 10, 15 years, for the purpose of just operating and maintaining the infrastructure we have according to certain clear performance indicators. So one of the things that Lauren brought up, I think, in Seattle that's crucial, whether that accident was caused by the lack of positive train control or not, just a footnote on that, the Europeans started researching positive train control back in the 1930s. That's how old it is. Of course, and this is the system for monitoring and controlling train movements with a focus on slowing or stopping the train. We could include that in a contract and say, look, guys, you have to incorporate positive train control in the operation of these passenger trains or you don't get paid by a certain date. And that gives them a pretty strong incentive, Tom. So we need those new policy approaches. Yep.
Well, you've thrown out a lot of really provocative ideas there, Rick, and we're going to get into them one at a time. I first want to go to Anya, who has some thoughts of her own. She's calling from here in Boston, Massachusetts. Anya, thanks for calling On Point. You're on the air.
So, yeah, it's a fascinating topic. It's a glaring problem. The infrastructure in my area is appalling, although there are some symptoms of improvement, but they are too small to be really optimistic. President Trump just cut trillions of dollars for in taxes for billionaires. Those are the money. We could have funding, beautiful funding. But of course, the problem of infrastructure is so deeply in mentality of American society, like kind of it doesn't exist really. It's not as important as maybe in Europe, like someone said that it's in Europe, it's not from the 30s, they've been preparing and training people. I don't just understand. How can it be in such appalling and horrible condition? And I see clearly that it's because there is no money, and the money should trickle down from the rich. And of course, the rich don't take responsibility because they live in a different realm. I would say in the rich houses with their planes and super duper cars, and they don't care.
And Anya, you referred to Europe, and I take it you're familiar with the state of infrastructure in Europe. And how do you compare that?
Oh, it's you know, you go to Germany and you feel like you land on a different planet.
Huh.
But what happens in Germany is taxes are really high, and indeed, people complain about taxes being too high, maybe, but. What you have in return, you have free education. That's a different topic. And also, you have phenomenal transportation system that it's beautiful, smooth, elegant, makes you feel good, and, you know, and modern. And here, it's archaic, primitive, and horrible and ugly. And I like what the experts said from Idaho or Ithaca said before, that you probably should not pay people or do something now, quickly, because, I mean, it's all great talk.
Okay, we got it, Anya. Thanks very much. Lauren, Anya is saying that Europeans have been, at least up till now, willing to pay higher taxes to fund their infrastructure. You know, how do you see the mood in Congress, for more funding for infrastructure?
So that's the big issue, right? And I think a lot of lawmakers, and particularly Democrats, saw a potential tax code overhaul, which is now, you know, becoming reality, as probably the best scenario for trying to infuse more funding into the nation's infrastructure. And that opportunity came and went. Republicans decided they did not want to tie infrastructure to a tax code overhaul. And I talked to Democrats and wrote a story last week, and many of them are kind of viewing the administration's forthcoming plan circumspect because they thought that was the best opportunity to get the level of federal funding that they're talking about to make it reality, and that did not happen.
Well, President Trump, in that tweet that we referred to earlier, noted that $7 trillion have been spent in the Middle East while our roads, bridges, tunnels, railways, and more crumble. Not for long. Seems to be blaming some of the funding issues on the war in the Middle East. I don't know whether $7 trillion is an exaggeration or not, but would seem from that tweet that President Trump is sort of laying the groundwork for saying it's not my fault if we don't have the money for this big infrastructure investment that we clearly need. We're taking an in-depth look at America's infrastructure after the power outage stranded thousands at Atlanta's International Airport and the train derailment in the Pacific Northwest. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're talking about American infrastructure and the proposals to repair it. You can join our conversation. Whose responsibility is it? The federal government, cities and states, or maybe private corporations? We have three top-notch guests to guide us through this complicated issue. Lauren Gardner is transportation reporter for Politico Pro. Rick Geddes is a professor at Cornell University and the director of the program in infrastructure policy. And Robert Puentes is the president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. And we have callers with their own thoughts and ideas about this issue. Let's go first to Mike. He's on the line from Manchester, Maryland. Mike, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
First thing I want to say is I'm a supporter of President Trump, and I think he made a very appropriate comment, which is this country spent over $7 trillion for wars still raging in the Middle East, and they were highly unjust. They were not provoked, and we should at least be able to spend some of that money towards our infrastructure. That's my first point. I think the second point I want to make here is regarding electric infrastructure. I spent 30 years in the electric industry, over a third of that time as a consultant, and I believe the point has not been raised by your panel, and it's an important point, which is electric delivery in this country is made by regulated utilities that have an economic incentive to invest in their systems to ensure safe, reliable, and dependable electric. I think the issue with Georgia Power is one of not having duplicate systems in place and duplicit systems in place. It's unfortunate what happened. It's a good utility, and they'll get it corrected. I think the problem with regard to our transportation and water systems is significantly different, and your panel is very correct in it. You have to get the incentives right. You have to have participation from, I believe, both state, federal, as well as private companies. There's incentives there that are not the same as in the electric industry. And I think that's the point I'd like to make today. I appreciate any feedback from your panel with regard to this, and I'll take your responses off the air. Thanks, Tom. It's a great show, and have a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Same to you, Mike. Thanks very much. So, Rob Puentes, let's put that the first of Mike's issues to you, which is that you can't consider this infrastructure challenge without considering the complications that regulatory issues bring to the picture. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, sure. It's really about this larger point that these different sectors of infrastructure are each designed and governed and financed and delivered very differently. The public sector has a big role in some. The private sector has a big role in others. There are these new public partnerships that are emerging between public and the private sector. So that's the challenge when we think about infrastructure, is that there are all these different actors that are involved. And as the caller was saying, when it comes to electricity, it's a different model. It's these private utilities, these public quasi-public utilities with a heavy government regulation on top of it. And then it gets into this question of the motivation that these are you know, when you're thinking about the private role in infrastructure, they're not doing it for necessarily altruistic reasons. They're doing it to make money. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's how we have to think about it. And so when we start moving to different models of public and private participation, we have to recognize that and keep that in mind, and that the private sector is not always going to have public policy goals in mind. And so as Rick was saying, we do see transit agencies and other folks moving to more of these different models of using private contractors to deliver services. And that's fine if we have the right incentives in place, and if we're only doing it to save money, and if we're doing it to cut costs and undermine workers, it's going to fail in every single case. This is what we've seen internationally. It's what we've seen in the United States. So it just gets back to this larger issue, is figuring out what are we trying to accomplish, who's the best to deliver it, and how do we make sure that public policy goals and objectives are maintained.
And Lauren, Mike's other point was that there's no sort of one-size-fits-all policy here or program that can deal with our infrastructure issue, because each sector of the infrastructure is unique and has its own challenges. How is the differences between sectors sort of dealt with in Congress? You know, is there sort of lump funding for infrastructure generally, or is there a kind of a sector-by-sector approach?
No, it's largely a sector by sector approach. You know, Amtrak has its own pots of funding. As I was talking about earlier, the Highway Trust Fund funds highway improvements and also transit. And like others have brought up, and I mentioned myself, the rail network across the country, outside of where Amtrak owns the tracks, that's largely privately dealt with because it's the freight lines that own it. So it is a very different approach depending on the mode of transportation. And what the administration is aiming to do through their new plan is to take what they're calling a, quote, mode neutral focus. So, you know, a broadband project, for example, something that we haven't really talked about today, but could be considered a type of infrastructure, could be competing for the same pot of money that a bridge project is.
Wow.
So that also raises the question of how would the administration deal with getting a number of applications for various types of infrastructure. Do you try and make sure that all of the money is doled out kind of broadly to different types? Or if the applications are best for one type of infrastructure over another, are they going to win out?
And Rick Geddes, another issue, you mentioned the attraction of per unit user fees. Now, I come from the Washington, D.C. area. We've just moved to a new toll road there, and the tolls are set sort of like are programmed in order to keep a particular number of cars on the road at the same time to maintain a proper speed. And what they have found there is that in order to limit the number of cars on the road to what the road can handle, they have to charge up to like $40 per trip, believe it or not. I mean, are these user fees a sort of a realistic way to approach, you know, the need for funding our infrastructure?
Yeah, well, great question, Tom. And I think you're focusing on the right sector, which is the surface transportation sector, with regard to user fees. But I think the example you used around the D.C. Beltway, which is these things called hot lanes, high occupancy or toll lanes, is perhaps not the right example, because you have the free service, in other words, the free lanes right next to the toll lanes. A better place to look would be out west, and specifically in the state of Oregon, which over the past 10 years has had three pilot programs focused on slowly switching from a per gallon fee to fund for their roads, which is a state gas or diesel tax, to a per mile traveled fee, okay? And you can call that a RUC, a road usage charge. Some people call them a mileage-based user fee. But the idea, Tom, is to make that switch for the entire system. So it's not just a specific lane or bridge or tunnel like it is around New York City. It's the entire system. And that's key, Tom, because, you know, in 1956, when we really raised the federal gas tax to pay for the interstate highway system, basically all the vehicles used gasoline. All the vehicles got about, four-door passenger car got about the same mileage. Now we have a lot of vehicles on the road that don't use gasoline at all, like a Tesla, use very little. Like a Prius, we have very different miles per gallon. The gas tax has become less fair. So I think, like I said before, we need that sustainable system-wide per unit charge that covers the cost of the system, and that gives us the reliable revenue stream we need to keep it up. Now, it turns out, Tom, that's a tough political transition to make. Other countries, Singapore is a leader, other countries are doing this. And I think that's the key, is really getting to a sustainable funding system. Then we can bring these innovative financing methods into play, like public-private partnerships.
Well, Rob was making the point that if you depend too much on private partners, you're sort of at the mercy of their calculations about what's in their economic interest as opposed to what's in the public interest.
Yeah, so that's a really good point, and that is why the contract, a PPP, actually is a reference to a contract between the public sector project sponsor and the private partner that's going to provide those services. But I want to go back to the caller, Mike, from Maryland. You know, his point about electricity is really good. Now, that's a system where the rates, you know, over half of the boilerplate generating capacity in the United States is provided by IOUs, investor-owned utilities, which are private. A lot of the other half is hydroelectric power. But, you know, part of the regulation at the state level of those IOUs is about the rates that they can charge. Everybody pays, you know, if you run your toaster in the morning, you're paying for those kilowatt hours of electricity. But those rates are carefully regulated to make sure the utility doesn't charge too much, but also that there's enough to cover current costs plus investment that needs to be made. And the system's not perfect, but it works pretty darn well in the United States. So I think a similar thing, Tom, a similar type of regulation, borrowing those regulatory lessons from, say, electricity and bringing those into public-private partnerships, you know, would be good, where the regulation is actually in the contract itself, in the PPP contract, Tom.
Okay. You know, speaking of power issues, one of our listeners who goes by the Twitter handle Dakota wants to remind us that while the power was off at Atlanta for just a few hours, Puerto Rico has been dark for months now, and that American citizens living in Puerto Rico might have something to say about infrastructure funding as well. And let's go now to Aaron, who's on the line from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Aaron, welcome to On Point. Do you have any thoughts about what works or doesn't work as far as infrastructure improvements are concerned?
Hi, Tom. Wanted to let you know the success that we have here in our county. A forward-thinking county commission decades ago dedicated a nickel of the tax rate and required that it only be spent on infrastructure repair and maintenance. And by doing so, we've created a culture of repair and maintenance where now we have 50-year-old schools that 2 weeks ago were the topic of a tour by the Secretary of Education to see a state-of-the-art mechatronics lab in a facility that was actually built 50 years ago, but is maintained systematically and intentionally to make sure that we have an inspirational educational environment.
All right, Aaron, thanks very much for that. And Lauren Gardner, you know, there seems to be a sort of a consensus on this panel that state and local governments can approach this problem creatively, and they can come up with their own funding mechanisms that make sense for their own constituencies. But to what extent are state and local governments going to be constrained in their fiscal capabilities going forward by what happens at the federal level? I mean, you know, we're also in an era of pretty major budget cuts that are going to affect state and local government capabilities, right?
That's an excellent question. So that's the big question that is being contemplated right now, is what is the level to which state and local governments can increase their own revenues to deal or come up with their own fees to deal with these questions that have been raised today. A lot of states have already moved to raise the gas tax. So when it comes to the administration's infrastructure plan, they're aware that some governments, lower levels of government, have already taken action, so they don't want to penalize them. But to the extent that states and local governments can do more, how much more can they do? That's a legitimate question, and it kind of remains to be seen. Obviously, the administration thinks that they can do more, you know, and how they do that would largely be up to them and probably to their voters, too.
And let's go now to Maria. She's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Maria, thanks for calling On Point. What are your thoughts today?
Well, Tom, my thoughts are rather wide-ranging, and regrettably, there's not enough bandwidth, so to speak, to present them I worked for my city's transit system, MARTA, for 32 years in the discipline of automatic train control, and then 10 years as a quality assurance and safety engineer. And it's very difficult to have a kumbaya moment where we can all agree that, you know, we'll share the wealth and we'll share the pain, because you will not know what a shriek heard around the world would be if you instituted a nickel gas tax for mass transit in this state.
In Atlanta, in Georgia.
The entire region. There is almost no psychological as well as imperative incentive for people to say, well, okay, I don't take my mass transit to get to work. Why should I pay for it? Right. You know, what it actually provides economic engine for this state. And that's very unfortunate.
All right, Maria, let me... I think I get a sense of where you're going. Let me put this question to Rick, to the Rick Geddes. To the extent that you need to sort of change people's habits, transportation habits, for example, in order to accommodate the changes that need to take place, how do you do that? She was Marta was talking about Maria was talking about the, you know, importance of getting people to consider mass transit where they maybe have been driving before.
Yeah. So it's a great point, Tom. And, you know, my background is in economics, so I think that everything goes back to economics 101. And the issue here is that, people say, let's get people out of their cars and get them into mass transit through subsidies or whatever it is. But the fundamental economic problem, Tom, that we need to address is the key input into driving is not properly priced. And that's the use of the roads, right? We charge, you know, per, as I've stressed, per unit for everything else. The problem is that the roads are free, essentially. There's no per unit charge. So what do you get? You get overuse of the roads, and that comes in the form of traffic congestion, particularly during peak times. So from an economic perspective, and again, cities and countries around the world are doing this more and more, if we can get the pricing of the roads correct, then we can get people using their mode, the different modes correctly. So I'll just stop there.
Okay. Well, what we've heard this morning is that the problem of infrastructure repairs and maintenance is very complicated, different problems in different sectors, a variety of solutions are going to be needed, a variety of actors need to get involved. I'd like to thank our guests. You just heard from Rick Geddes, professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell University. Rick Geddes, glad to have you with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Rob Puentes is the president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation. And Rob, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, Tom. Great discussion.
And finally, Lauren Gardner, transportation reporter for Political Pro. Lauren, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.